This is one of the most disturbing and most cruel forms of man's inhumanity to his fellow man. Those with power to reject their fellow human beings impose upon the rejected human being the requirement of accepting the rejection.
Hello, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold, Issues in Mental Health. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. As a foundation, we believe that we are most effective in transforming mental health at the community level when we focus on historically excluded or marginalized populations. On numerous occasions, past and present, we have made the connection between mental health and well-being on the one hand, and a more just and equitable world on the other. In recognition of Black History Month, we're exploring once again the relationship between well-being and equity. This time by reaching deep into our archives to share a conversation between two trailblazers, Dr. Kenneth Clark and Bert Krueger Smith. Bert Krueger Smith, who worked for the Hogg Foundation from 1952 until she retired in 1983, left an indelible mark as one of the most influential employees in the foundation's history as a program officer, writer, speaker, and radio host. Dr. Kenneth Clark was a renowned African-American psychologist who, in tandem with his wife, Mamie Phipps Clark, conducted pioneering research on the effects of discrimination on children's attitudes about race. Their work played an influential role in the legal struggles against segregation in the 1950s. They testified as expert witnesses in Briggs v. Elliott, one of the cases rolled into the historic Brown v. Board of Education case of 1954. What you are about to hear is from a 1974 episode of The Human Condition, a radio series produced by the Hogg Foundation that ran from 1971 to 1983 on KUT, hosted by Bert Krueger Smith. It is a rare opportunity to hear Dr. Kenneth Clark, who passed away in 2005 at the age of 90, in his own words. It is also an outstanding example of an earnest dialogue about the relationship between mental health and the everyday conditions in which people live, learn, work, play, and pray, a focus that is still at the center of the Hogg Foundation's work. Much of what you're about to hear from Dr. Clark in this 1974 episode may at first sound like narratives from long ago, but pieces still ring true today. In fact, in a 2015 episode of Into the Fold, this podcast, we explored the anxiety and dread of undocumented children who live under the threat of deportation. Here is Dr. Luis Zayas, Dean of the Steve Hicks School of Social Work at the University of Texas at Austin.
And so I've always had an interest in what happens to marginalized, disenfranchised communities, especially the children in those communities. Actually, starting in 2005, about 10 years ago, I was called by some attorneys to come and evaluate a little girl whose father was in deportation hearings. And I was fascinated by this six-year-old girl who had really internalized or embodied all of the proscriptions of her parents. Don't talk. Don't tell anybody about us. Behave. And those sorts of things. To the point where the girl was mute. She would not talk to anyone at school. She didn't talk at school for nearly a year. It was a case of selective mutism.
And in episode 56 in 2018, we talked to Dr. Kristen Smith, an associate professor of African and Diaspora Studies and Anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin, about the effects of police violence on Black women's health.
I have been for several years looking at the adverse effects of police violence on the families of people who have been killed. And in doing that work, I have been seeing over and over again that in the wake of the killings of Black people by the police, oftentimes the mothers, the sisters, the daughters, the aunts, the family members, the girlfriends of people who have been killed are suffering devastating health effects. And most of those devastating health effects have a lot to do with the trauma and the depression that they feel as a result of the death of their loved ones.
Turning now to Dr. Clark, you will hear echoes of his humane concern for the well-being and psychological fragility of children who have to move through the oppressive structures that adults create.
From Communications Center, the University of Texas at Austin, this is another program in the series, The Human Condition.
As a psychologist, I would have to say, and on the basis of my studies and observations of what prejudice and segregation and discrimination, what these things do to the developing human being, the white children must be confused.
Produced in association with the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health at the University of Texas at Austin, these conversations are about people and mental health as a part of every human experience. Producer Bert Kruger-Smith's guest this week is Dr. Kenneth Clark, president of Clark, Phipps, Clark & Harris, Incorporated in New York City.
Dr. Clark, you wrote a most interesting sounding book called Prejudice in Your Child. Now, this came out in 1955, and I'd like to know what was the condition of prejudice and children more than two decades ago, and how has it changed, if it has?
Well, it's difficult for me to conceive of the fact that it's been over 20 years since that book came out. It was my first book. It was written as a result of some work that I did for the Mid-Century White House Conference on Children and Youth, which was held in Washington in 1950. And I was asked to look at the literature in the field of psychology and sociology to determine what do the social scientists know about the effects of the American form of prejudice, discrimination, and segregation on personality development of American children. I don't know whether you recall that that was the first White House conference that was concerned with personality development rather than physical or mental problems of children. And at the last moment, the advisory committee to that conference felt that maybe prejudice was an important area to examine, and they asked me to do it, and I did, and I learned quite a bit from reviewing the literature that the American pattern of racial prejudice and segregation did affect personality development, the self-image, the sense of personal worth of not only minority children, rejected children, but the literature indicated very strongly, and I put it in the book, that it affected the privileged children, you know, white children who were supposed to be the beneficiaries, also were disturbed with deep sense of guilt and personal responsibility for being accessories to unfairness, and in some cases, cruelty inflicted upon other human beings.
It has taken us a long time, hasn't it, Dr. Clark, to understand that prejudice, poverty, disease, all of these ills don't stay on any one side of a community,
oh, yes,
but affect us all.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because we summarized that material for the United States Supreme Court in its consideration of the school segregation cases, which led to the Brown decision of May 17, 1954. And it is interesting that the court referred to our findings concerning the effects of prejudice and discrimination on minority group children, you know, the Negro, the black children, it did in fact say that it led to deep feelings of inferiority, which would affect their hearts and minds in ways unlikely ever to be undone. But the court did not refer to another part of our summary in the social science brief, which was submitted to the Supreme Court, namely the effects on white children, the moral and ethical conflicts which a racial system and a system of racial segregation imposed upon these children, and their conflicts in relationship to their attitudes toward their own parents or ministers, churches, you know, who on the one hand would teach them the democratic principles upon which our nation was founded, and these same individuals, these same institutions, would be agents of segregation and racial unfairness and prejudice. And this inflicted upon these children profound moral conflicts, which sometimes they, maybe most of the times, they reacted by rejecting the fact that there is a conflict, you know, and just accepting the values of a dog-eat-dog world. But some of the more sensitive children carried it as a personal burden and a personal responsibility which they found difficult to cope with.
You know, Dr. Clark, my mother was an immigrant from Russia, knew a great deal of persecution there, and became quite a well-known poet in this country. And I can still remember one of her poems that was much quoted during Brotherhood Week observances, but it was, "What color is your face, God? Black is mine as I turn from black to brown," and so on. And of course, you were saying that it was very hard to reconcile what they heard in the pulpit and what they did in real life.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Clark,
speaking of your mother being from Russia, I taught at the College of the City of New York for 34 years until I retired June of 75. And one of the most tragic and poignant experiences as a professor who happened to be black at City College was having in the 50s some of my students who were the children of refugees, German refugees, come to my office, and many of them crying at the extent to which their parents, who were victims of persecution in Germany or Europe, would come to America and would be mouthing anti-black prejudices, and some of my more sensitive children, as I said, would cry in my office and said, and I'd have to sort of explain to them that their parents were human beings with the frailties of human beings, and by no means should they reject them.
No, but you'd think we'd learn.
Yes, but there's something about the human proclivity toward deprecating other human beings that is not peculiar to America by any means. It seemed to be a lack of moral completeness that you find among human beings almost throughout the world.
I can remember hearing stories about the Jews in Germany who were so bitterly persecuted by Hitler, who after a while began to feel, many of them, there must be something wrong with us, else we wouldn't be so persecuted. And I'm sure that's what happened to black children and black families.
That's not at all uncommon whenever you find an oppressed group or a disturbingly high percentage of the oppressed group to internalize the sense of unworthiness, you know, to begin to incorporate in their own image of themselves the strong possibility that they may not be more worthy than the deprecation.
There becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Without question. This is one of the most disturbing and most cruel forms of man's inhumanity to his fellow man. Those with power to reject their fellow human beings impose upon the rejected human being the requirement of accepting the rejection.
You know, it's been said if you want to know what a society is like, you have only to look at how the powerful treat the powerless.
That's right. I think it was someone who said if you really want to know the nature of the morality and solidity of a civilization, look at its prisons. I would also add, look at its ghettos.
And if I may add just one more thing, Dr. Clark, some Greek philosopher has said, when those who have not been injured become as indignant as those who have, we're moving toward a sense of justice.
That is, to me, a very important, very profound and true statement, that we will have stability, moral stability and justice in a society when those who are not the immediate victims of injustice feel as intensely the injustice as the victim himself.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Clark, when we get into this area of school busing, and it seems to be one that is taking some time to settle in, I'm wondering, from your studies and from what you know, what does happen to children, both white and black, when busing becomes quite an issue and when parents are incensed?
Yes, the disturbing thing about the busing issue is that it is really a spurious issue. Children have been transported to school by buses for decades. Millions of children are transported to school in rural and suburban and urban areas by means of bus. In New York State, you know, where I serve as a member of the Board of Regents of State of New York, we expend millions of dollars each year to transport children to private and parochial schools. And this is taxpayers' money. The borough president of Manhattan, who happens to be black, Percy Sutton, went to the Board of Estimate with a group of parents who were asking that the fiscal crisis not in New York City not deny them the right to have their children transported to private parochial and parochial schools by buses. So the matter of busing in itself is not a solid issue. What is the issue is when that small percentage, and it is less than 5% of children, are being transported for purposes of desegregation of the schools. Then the issue of busing becomes a highly emotional, historical issue. Well, it doesn't require one to be a scientist to know that the determining factor there is not busing. It is race.
Which is why I'm asking the question of what does happen in the minds of children, for example, when they see their parents really incensed over this issue. Is this going to set us back? Forward, are there other methods from
Purity? Well, let's take Little Rock, you know, and Little Rock is at the height of the desegregation disturbance 20 years ago. Those youngsters today in Central High School, according to all reports, and unfortunately I haven't visited myself, but I've read about, they are free. They are free of the hysteria, they are free of the emotion, they are free of the venom that is being inflicted upon those poor children in Boston. As a psychologist, I would have to say, and on the basis of my studies and observations of what prejudice and segregation and discrimination, what these things do to the developing human being, the white children must be confused. They must feel, and even those who act out racial venom, you know, by throwing rocks or calling black children names, or, and certainly the black children who act out their resentment and aggression, if they have, and all human beings would seem to me to have some modicum of sensitivity, some sense of fairness, they must occasionally step back and say, what is this all about? What are my parents doing to me, and what are they really saying, and how does this square with the Declaration of Independence, you know, and the Bill of Rights? It would seem to me either that would happen, or you're dealing with a totally insensitive human being, and to me, that level of insensitivity is itself a symptom.
What can people like us do to affect some positive changes?
Well, one of the things that I've been suggesting to my friends in the South is that in the 1970s, 1976, in the next year or two, concerned and sensitive Southerners react to and communicate with the North the way Northerners were preaching to Southerners in the middle 50s, you know, that there'd be a reversal of role. Now, when I say that, some people think I'm joking. I'm not joking at all. I mean, I think that the South has gone through its crises, you know. It has gone through its emotional and hysterical response to Brown, and with some exceptions, of course, seem to have weathered it. And seemed to me all the more stable for it. And I'm fully aware of the proliferation of predominantly white private academies in the South. But when you look at the whole picture of public accommodation, you know, transportation, there is a healthier social, political pattern in the South. Must now help the North, particularly on the school situation, to understand that the wave of the future is not for white working class or ethnics in the North to resist the inevitable interaction among the variety of human beings who comprise this. I think it would be probably better if Southern whites assume this responsibility in helping blacks educate our Northern brothers and sisters.
Let me ask you a personal question from your vantage point as a psychologist, Dr. Clark. You were talking about the fact that so many black children got the feeling of inferiority and maintained it throughout their lifetimes. Despite some of these problems that you have mentioned, do you think that the mental health, the self-image of black children as they grow up in general is better? Are they seeing more role models of achieving blacks?
Yes, I think that the whole period of the civil rights, civil disobedience period, Martin Luther King, that period of the 60s, where there seemed to have been accelerated movement toward not just racial confrontation, but was resolved toward racial justice, did a great deal to give the black child a sense of his own worthiness, that he was worthy enough to be for people to be concerned about, you know. I don't believe that period of, which was largely a northern phenomenon, of black separatism, black militants, and black rhetoric, was as helpful, but I don't think it hurt very much. I think the most helpful thing in increasing the sense of personal worthiness among black children were the actions of the constructive democratic confrontations and litigation and civil disobedience, which characterized the 60s.
So you have hope for us?
Oh, without question. I think that there is no question that America will either move toward social and racial justice or stagnate. And I don't think that America can afford to stagnate at this period of human history.
We think Dr. Clark was right when he said, "We will have moral stability and justice in the society when those who are not the immediate victims of injustice feel as intensely the injustices as the victim himself." Moral stability and justice, as he put it, are key building blocks for what the Hogg Foundation currently means by well-being. We recently defined well-being in a blog post series called Three Things to Know that explores concepts influencing community mental health and our grant making. Well-being is about more than just survival or the absence of illness. It is a positive state of flourishing, connectedness, safety, and control of destiny. I've included a link to this blog post and others in this series on social determinants of mental health, health equity, and resilience in the episode description. The dialogue that you just heard between Bert Krueger Smith and Kenneth Clark is just one example of the rich audio history captured in conversation for the human condition. During its near 400-episode run, the show explored mental health, philosophy, sociology, and other aspects of what it means to be human. And it featured such notables as Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, the celebrated pediatrician, Oscar-winning actress Mercedes McCambridge, and the influential Holocaust historian Raoul Hilberg. A sample of the show archive can be found on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You'll find a link in the episode description. That does it for this very special episode of Into the Fold. Thank you so much for joining us.